Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Design Truth. My name's Brad, and me and my design mate Wynn catch up with different parts of the industrial design world, get some perspective, and hopefully keep one or two listeners interested on a dog walk or a commute after a crappy day at work. And today we're joined by Tony Ryan, CEO of the Design and Technology Association. We'll all remember those early days with our relationship with design, you know, long before you probably even knew it was going to be your career. We find out why that subject is important and as important as ever. Some troubling stats and trends of where it's heading, but more importantly, a call to action from Tony of why we've only got 4 years to save the subject. I'm not a massive fan generally of asking people to do things. But this podcast has kind of grown organically now for quite some time, which has been great. And if you did half enjoy this episode, it'd be really, really great if you could just share it with a friend, tag someone in the comments or something, share it with a design colleague of yours, past, present, alumni, lecturer, maybe a client, you know, you pick, even, you know, share it on the socials, whatever works for you. The links to the things that Tony's going to be chatting to us about, they're all in the descriptions as always. Follow the links, track Tony down. Tony Ryan is his name. If you wanted to get involved in really reshaping the future of D&T. So I'll see you on the other side. Oh, and thanks Solid Solutions for sponsoring the podcast. That was poor from me that. I do apologise. I should have plugged you far earlier. So thank you.
To the Design Truth podcast. We'll be looking forward to inviting you for quite a few weeks and months now, and really pleased to have you on. It's obviously an interesting subject and something that touches, I think, all designers in industry, the topic of design education, and to have you on is a big scalp for us as Design Truth, to have someone who's got a unique perspective of design education. I know it's a big, curious subject, and we're really pleased to have a bit of a chat over the next hour or so, and take it from there. Really, we've got some questions from people via social media, and Brad and I have got some intrigues as well. I'm sure you've got some things you'd like to tell us and tell the rest of the world out there, and we're really pleased to have you on. So thanks for coming, Tony.
Thanks for the invite. I really appreciate it. It's a topic I could talk about all day. So I'll try and keep it succinct. Eh?
Yeah. Also, the last time we caught up, it was one of those moments where it was like, shit, you know, we're an hour in. we've actually got a day job to do here. So if you see the recording, it says 3 hours on it, then, you know, we apologise in advance. But to people that don't know who you are, Tony, it'd be good if you could just introduce yourself to the masses, I guess.
Of course. Tony Ryan, Chief Exec of the Design and Technology Association. Probably help if I gave you a little bit of an outline of what the association is, what it does. We've been around since 1989. Founded really to look after the subject in schools as it was developing and emerging in schools. It is the newest subject area on the curriculum. It's only been around 35 years, and it's gone through various evolutions along the way. And I think it's fair to say the association's gone through various evolutions as well. I took over 4.5 years ago. As chief exec. Before that, I was in secondary education all my life, really. I'm 33 years and 18 years in senior leadership and 12 years as a head of two large London comprehensives. So, yeah, it's been quite a weird journey. I've sort of come full circle from teaching the subject, learning to teach it right the way through, moving away from it into senior leadership, and then come back to it 30 odd years later. Full circle.
Nice. What got you into it in the first place?
Well, into teaching.
Yeah.
Long story, I'll keep it short. I hated school, which is really weird for a head teacher to say, isn't it? But it just never connected with me. There was I was bright enough, but I was made to feel quite stupid at school. I remember a careers interview when I was in what is year 10 now. And they said to me, what do you want to do? And my mouth said car mechanic. My head hadn't engaged with that at all. I said, what do I need? They said maths, English and one other. So I got maths, English and one other. I'm fairly convinced if she'd have said eight, I'd have got eight. But she said three, so I got three. And I became a car mechanic. And I loved it because with a car in front of me and an engine in front of me, everything that didn't make sense at school made sense. It was context there. It was like, oh, that's why I need that physics. That's why that maths is important. So the whole lot came together and I just consumed qualifications. I just ate them up and couldn't do enough really to learn. I took a whole year where I took a day a week holiday so as I could go on day release and do a HNC because I just wanted to learn. And then I looked around the workshop and it's the age of 22, I guess it was. And I looked at some of the old boys who were probably only late 30s, early 40s. And I just thought, I can't do this for all my life. So I needed to get a degree and teaching was an easy way in. But the idea was jump in, get a degree, jump out again. I jumped in. I loved it. And I thought, I'm not going to jump out. I just love this. You know, I remember the first class that I ever taught. And it was in a school in Greenwich, quite a tricky school at the time. And I was supposed to have somebody sit at the back of the room and watch me teach this lesson. And after 5 minutes, he got up and left. And it was the longest 55 minutes of my life. But I survived. And one of the kids thanked me on the way out the door. And I just thought, oh, yeah, OK, I'm in now. This is it. I'm done. So, yeah, I've loved education. It's been fantastic. Loved every minute of it. And trying to save the subject now because the subject's under threat, which I guess we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, so I think that'd be something to I think jump into. I think we were really pleased to be part of a roundtable session last week and another one coming up next Thursday. You've got some quite stark statistics, and I think that'd be good to start with. I mean, in any kind of design situation, we want to know what the problem is so we can understand how we want to help solve it. Please run us through some of the headlines that I think people out there maybe aren't aware of.
Okay. We did this research work. I mean, honestly, the research has told us very little that we didn't know or couldn't allude to already. But what it's done is it's put it in one document. And it's you can't argue with it really. It's there on paper. So I'll run through some of the data and just sort of it'll give you an idea of just how urgent this is. GCSE entry numbers from 2009. We had to pick a point somewhere. And at 2009, we had 280,000 students doing GCSE in design technology. And that's dropped by 136,000, so or 51.5%. So we've had a half of the students we used to have. It's actually worse than that. If you go back further than that, we were the first country in the world to make design and technology compulsory back in the day. So at its peak, it was 440,000 students across the UK doing design and technology. And we were world leaders, which just breaks my heart that, you know, we had something. We had something special and we've just let it slip through our hands. A-level, similar. We've gone from 22,160 down to 10,430. So, you know, that's a 53% reduction. We found that sponsored academies and free schools are less likely to offer design and technology. And that's important to know is that if you're a free school or you're an academy, same thing, really, different names, you've got complete autonomy on your curriculum offer. So you can offer pretty much whatever you like. As long as you can justify it to Ofsted, you can change your curriculum offer. And a lot of schools are opting not to teach design and technology for all sorts of reasons, which we'll touch on later. Ironically, in the independent sector, I don't think it's ever been so strong. And that's worth examining. You know, what is it about the subject that hasn't got a stigma in the independent sector, but is looked upon as being vocational and low grade in the mainstream sector? And, you know, it's the same subject, so I'm not quite sure what's going on there. GCSE particularly low in London. There's one borough that's only 4% of kids in that borough. Probably shouldn't name the borough, but it's one that I used to teach in, where every school in that borough used to teach design and technology, but now only 4% of kids are doing any qualification in it. The Northeast, Yorkshire and the Humber, I think all of that is leading towards technical qualifications, nationals, BTECs. They tend to lead better towards perhaps apprenticeships. So in those parts of the country, I can understand that. We've got some areas of the country that are really strong, Southwest, East Midlands, East of England, Southeast, all above national average. So there is some good news. We have less than half the number of teachers specially trained to teach design and technology that we had in 2009. And that's a big issue now, because a lot of schools are saying, the school leadership saying, we want to teach the subject, we actually see the value of it, but we just can't find the right leadership. Mm-hmm. And if we can't get the right leader into the subject area, the results will be awful, so therefore we can't deliver it. And then the other bit really is that overall the picture is there is nothing in the data that suggests any of this is going to change unless we do something fairly dramatic to shift the direction. So we haven't got another 10 years to fix this. We've probably got four.
At that current rate of decline, I mean, as a, you know, looking forward, what if you were to kind of paint a picture of 5 years' time, what would you say it is by the current state of that? And then also potentially the follow-on through then to university education or tertiary education?
We would down to, if we carry on at the current rate of decline, in 5 years' time, we'll be down to around 60,000 entries at GCSE. And we'll be down to an A-level entry of somewhere in the region of 6,000-7,000. That's pretty much aligned with something like photography. And so we'd be marginalized on the curriculum, and you're going to get less kids coming out of school with some of the skill sets and some of the core knowledge that they might need to go on and do certain qualifications thereafter. Yeah. One of the issues, to be honest, Wynn, is even when there were qualifying subjects in for degree courses, you would have thought that design and technology might be a qualifying subject for industrial design, for example. It's never been a qualifying subject for any degree course. And the reasons given for that are that if you've got maths and physics, then we can teach the design bit in the middle. And I sort of get that, but I also, you know, what people will then tell you offline is, yeah, but the kids that have done design and technology actually do arrive with an advantage. So we're sort of shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit there, but through not valuing it enough to put it high enough up the scale that kids will want to do it. And it be seen as whatever academic is, you know, this label academic that we put on it in the UK, we're seen as not being academic enough.
Yeah, just to jump in there, two things. There's, one of them is that, because maybe an outsider perspective, but if it's not valued early on, that does that knock on to why people go, well, no one understands the value of design? You know, it's that whole kind of, if people in that classroom setting, they're not exposed to it. So therefore, you know, as their careers develop in business or whatever, they equally don't have that value of the profession. And secondly, what kind of impact, whether you've got data or it's just opinion, but are those declining numbers starting to impact things at a university level where, you know, could we start seeing courses closing down because they can't get the numbers through the door? Or actually are on that front things still okay with the student numbers at in that kind of university level?
My impression is at the moment things are okay. They're getting the numbers through, but the decline, if it continues, I think it will impact. I think part of the issue is, and like I've got to be really honest with this, it's a really difficult admission, is that a lot of people don't really know what design and technology is. They don't really know, you know, you go back to it in your head to when you were at school, and it was a very different creature when I was at school or when you guys were. It would have been very craft based. It would have been very, very process based. Whereas now it is very much a thinking subject, a problem solving subject, and a design subject. It's hard. And it's changed, and we haven't advertised that enough. So people, when they think design and technology, it was really well described to me by a parent a while ago that said, you know, I went into a workshop a while ago, he said, to see my son's work. And the minute I walked in, there was a smell that I recognized from when I was 13, 14, which is like sawdust and filings all mixed in the air. And he said, and then I saw 3D printers and laser cutters and CAD and all these things going on. And he said, what you need is a smell for the 21st century. And I just, I love that because, yeah, that is what we need. We need a different smell.
Any suggestions? Yeah. Put them in the comments.
It's a lovely metaphor, though. Lovely
metaphor. I think when you're saying that, it's obviously, you know, I went to university between 1999 and 2002, I think, yeah, CAD and CAM was kind of coming into the curriculum a lot more then. And obviously, I'm 20 years, maybe longer than that. No, I'm 20 years out of that experience. And so when you say it's translated more to a thinking subject, obviously a lot of designers listening to this, the industrial designers would cringe at the word design thinking. And from a point of view of that, has that and technology, are they separated to a certain extent, or
no? It's integral, which is why it's really hard to teach if you've not been trained to do it. You know, if you've gone from where we were, which is, I think the best way to do it is to give you an example. You know, if I went back 6 years and I had a GCSE class in front of me, and wood was my thing because I'd come from a woodwork background, maybe as a teacher. I could fix it. So every kid in class in front of me designed something made out of wood. So I might say, okay, we're going to make something out of wood that's going to be multi-purpose piece of furniture, which is going to go in the home. You need to pick a user for it, which could be mum, dad, brother, sister, whatever. It's got to have more than one purpose. Away you go, design and make it. And at the end of the year, we'd have a beautiful showcase of loads of different bits of pretty well-made furniture quite often. But what are we doing there? We're creating furniture makers. You know, we don't need furniture makers. So the way the subject's changed is that you now get given a context, and that context can be really, really simple. And if I give you two from the last couple of years, one would be an aging population. So that's the context you're given by the example. Now, as a student, that's all you're given. And you've got to think, right, how do I make sense of that? All right, an aging population. Let's do some research. Let's find out. Okay, we have got a population that is getting older. So I've got to find a problem in that area. And I've not only got to find a problem, I've got to find a user. I've then got to get inside that user's head and work out where they're at. So there's empathy that is needed there for that, which is really difficult to ask of a 15-year-old, really. Because, you know, at the age of 15, the world revolves around you. And all of a sudden, you've got to put yourself in someone else's space. And then you've got to design a prototype. It hasn't got to be an end product. So it might not be the shiny piece at the end, but you might do five or six prototypes towards creating a solution. Another example of a context that was given a while ago by one of the boards was just one word, sustainability. So that's it. That's the word you got. Go find a problem, find a context, find a user, design something, prototype it, bring it forward. And you've got to learn about all the materials, all the processes, all the machinery, so as you can actually create a solution that is fit for purpose. So it's become, when I say a thinking subject, you've got to piece a lot of peripheral bits together in order to put a solution in place. And I genuinely feel we're one of the few subjects on the curriculum where failing's all right. You know, we have an education system that is fail-proof at the moment. Everyone has got to pass. Everyone has got to get here. But actually, our subject, the kids walk in there and we say, we actually want you to fail, because in failing, you're going to learn how to do it better.
Now, is that something that the people writing the courses, people like yourself, are saying that, but realistically, are the students happy with that kind of a subject where you are failing, and ultimately probably their parents, people that guiding them and kind of going, if you're not from a design background, then, you know, it could easily kind of get misconstrued as a craft-based subject, and, oh, you haven't done, you know, when I was at school, you know, if you didn't do a weld correctly or didn't do a dovetail joint properly or something, then you'd get marked down. And I'm interested in that, where it's, yeah, do the students kind of get that, you know, as a message.
And there you come back into the quality of teaching in the first place. If the teaching is good, then yeah, the kids do get that. They absolutely understand that written into the process that you're going to use, you're going to fail. You know, you can't innovate without failure. So you are going to fail. So the teachers that are teaching well and are teaching the whole picture will say to the kids, look, I'm going to let you go sometimes, and I'm going to let you find out things the hard way, because that's the only way really that you learn properly. Will the parents get that? There's an awful lot of work to do to inform parents about the changes in the subject, because a lot of parents still see it as what it was. So there's a lot of transitional work there. But we're still a new subject. This is the thing. We're, you know, we've only been in the curriculum a short period of time. So we haven't got the history and the background of a geography or even a business studies. You know, that's been there.
One of the subjects is probably going to change and will always change, right? I mean, you know, industrial design has come from mechanical design, industrial design, product design, and now it's very much, you know, it's kind of translating to a digital field. And soon we'll all have Meta VR headsets on. You know, it's all those things. It's going to always change. And I think the interesting for me is when you talk about this kind of context, and that, you know, when we say the real world, you know, and that kind of scary place outside, and that's how it operates, right? I mean, just chats I've had the last couple of weeks have been with an IVF company, menopause company, ocean plastics, a cancer company, or cancer-based, not cancer company, but a company that helps cancer patients. And those are the problems, right? And then you, like I said, you're doing those things, and that's what happens in the real world. And you come with a problem-based and a user focus is, you know, in that sense of one thing I've noticed when I did a spell of lecturing in Australia for 6-7 years. And one of the things I found interesting was that I think you can do those user and finder context situations. And I think with a bit more maturity, it becomes a bit easier. But it often comes down to you assessing that one person. And I'm just wondering whether or not there's ever a scope to think about kind of, I don't know, rewarding people for collaborative parts of those skills, because that's essentially what you're looking at in industry, is not one designer can ever do a design on their own. They can't. It's virtually impossible in this day and age to do industrial design, UX, UI, some mechanics, some electronics. It's just, you can't do all of that. So I'm just wondering whether or that's something as well that, in that kind of, you know, problem-based kind of context, that could be developed as well.
Technically, you can. I mean, technically, as part of your GCSE work, it doesn't have to be a project on your own. You can work with others on it. Practically, tends not to happen, because the teachers will say, do you know what? It's much, much easier if you just pick one yourself, and it makes it easier to single it out. And I absolutely get that. But the thing comes into, you know, we've got a minimum of 5 years to prepare kids for GCSE. You know, you get them in year 7 and then they come up to year 11. You've actually got longer in some cases, because the kids will get a good experience at primary school and will work through. So, and that's happening more and more now. But you've got a minimum of 5 years. And what we can't afford to do is mess around in year 7, 8, and 9. And I say mess around, I mean, that's a very disparaging term, but I see this in some schools where it's like, we're going to make this. I want a project that is going to make this. And it's all about the end product. We're going to make a clock. You know, I'll keep using it as an example. I've got one here. Hang on in one sec. This baby came home with my daughter in year 7.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's plywood pieced together. I mean, I'm going to keep it forever because I'm a dad, you know, and you do the dad bit where you look at it and you go, oh, that's lovely. That's fantastic. And then the D&T teacher bit kicks in and you think, right, she spent forever cutting this out with a coping saw, sanding it down, gluing it together, What has she actually learned through doing this? What has she picked up? She might have learned how to use a coping saw. She could have learned that in 5 minutes on cutting one bit. This took 7 weeks. And there's the problem, is that we can't afford to lose time like that. We've got to teach kids quickly the skills that they need in order to allow them to design at higher levels much, much quicker.
That follows in quite nicely into a we've had some questions, and I've had one, mind me mentioning his name, Tom Burke, who's from North Wales, someone that I know well, and he asked the question, how do we deal with the balance of teaching technical ability and design foundations? Technology moves quickly, software changes all the time, but the principles of design are pretty solid. Teaching one often means the neglect of another. What would your response to that be?
Curriculum design is critical with this. You have got to, I think the real art of putting a curriculum together that allows you to pick up kids in year seven that are going to have very, very little in the way of knowledge, skills, and character sets. And you're building character sets in the subject as well. And I don't think enough time's given to that, but I'll come back to that in a minute. So there's a whole body of knowledge that you need to know. CAD will be part of that. Materials will be part of that. Processes, tool use, machine use, all of that comes in. But at the same time, you want to produce context that allow the kids to really design, really create, and really come up with something that's different. And when you look at, I've got back to the clock just doesn't do it. There's not enough there for the kids to get hold of in order to really use their curiosity to create something that is unknown to them, that they're exploring something new. I don't think it's one or the other. I do get it's difficult. I don't want to make it sound easy, because it's not. But I don't think it's one or the other. I think if your curriculum design is good, then you're going to build year on year to a point where in year 10 or year 11, as a teacher, you can pretty much stand back and say, there's the problem. I'm now facilitating you. I'm not teaching you. Away you go. And definitely at A level, you want the students to be bringing a problem to you. And you really do want to be facilitating 50% of the time at least.
Without turning Design Truth into a political broadcast, which I would never do, what's the kind of, because a lot of this stuff is linked with government, right? So, they're the ones that can create kind of change here in a lot of kind of context. But what's their appetite towards D&T as a subject? And thinking that, there's an election going to be coming up, I'm sure, and in the not so distant future, and it. I'd imagine there's some kind of correlation there between who's been in power and maybe the state of play since that 2009 that you mentioned.
There's very little appetite, Brad, is the answer. It is seen as, one minister that I spoke to a few years ago called it a hobby subject. And that pretty much puts it in its box. It's the sort of thing that you could do in a club after school was their view. And it shouldn't be on the mainstream curriculum, was their view as well. If same person said, you want to be an engineer, you do maths and physics, and the design stuff you pick up as you go along, or you're born with it, one or the other. It's one of those things that either drops on you from on high or you're born with it, you can't teach it. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. We know it's nonsense. The design industry is worth nearly £100 billion to the economy. Yet we take it for granted. We've always been good at it. That 100 billion is without government support pretty much. So if the government supported it, you could probably double that. You could probably, with the right vision, you could probably double that. But the vision isn't there. And at the moment, there is some talk of skills, which there hasn't been for a long time. But all of the talk is post-16. So you go through a knowledge crammed curriculum up to the age of 16. Then you go for your summer holidays at 16 and you come back a vocational beast that wants to learn in a completely different way. The world doesn't work like that. You've got to bring it further down the school, and you've got to show students. And we have a unique problem in the UK, which everyone will know, is that if I'm in France, if I'm in Germany, if I'm in Sweden, then actually an engineer is an academic. But in the UK, an engineer means somebody with overalls and greasy hands, and it means lower level to some people on first glance. And that's a unique problem to the UK. And that problem sifts into government as well, where they think that it's at technician level only. And actually, it's much, much bigger than that. So long answer, but the short answer is there isn't much appetite for it at the moment. I think there has to be. The skills shortages that we've got in certain sectors at the moment are only going to get worse unless we really start tackling it at an earlier level. And I'm not saying, I want to make this clear, I'm not saying the whole purpose of school is to turn out the next generation of engineers, designers, whatever it might be. The whole purpose of school is to give students a broad education that allows them to then thrive in life. Now, whatever you do in life, an appreciation of design and an appreciation of technology and an appreciation of how that technology touches you as a person is a thing that I would say is an essential now. It's not a nice to have. And I think there's your answer of why it is a must have in the independents. If I'm paying £35,000 a year for education, this isn't an after-school club. This is on the curriculum, and I want my son or daughter to have it. If it's good enough for those kids, it's good enough for kids that are from a council estate in Acton. And that's the issue that I've got, is the disparity between the two is was always wide, but it's getting wider.
Do you think that the... just thinking about our internship pledge and things like that, do you think the infrastructure currently in school education is effectively set up to intentionally or unintentionally or whatever, but effectively, if you're born into money or you have money, you can succeed in design? But if you're not, unless you're incredibly talented, you just are not going to get...
Yeah,
you're not going to pursue a career in design. It's impossible.
If you're looking at, you know, I've been in the room with 40, 50, 60 designers on many occasions in my job. I've never asked the question, but if I had asked the question, how many of you have come from a real working class background where you've had to fight your way to get here? You're probably looking at less than 10% in that room. The rest are pretty middle class and have come through a certain set, and predominantly white. And predominantly
male. Yeah.
And predominantly male. And what some companies are starting to realize is it will always be that way unless you actually change your recruitment, unless you look at things differently. And we have got some really enlightened companies now that are joining us as part of our blueprint program, where they're coming to us and saying, get us into schools that we wouldn't normally be into, because we want to talk to a more diverse audience, because kids will switch off. I mean, the research says that girls switch off at primary school. You know, at a very young age, they decide engineering's not for me. So if we haven't got in and made them see how attractive it can be as a career very early, by the time they're 12 or 13, it's too late. So, yeah, we you know, how many architects do you know that have come from a working class background? You know, that's the way I would answer that one.
When you think about, there was a BEDA survey, when was it, Brad? 2015, I think, British Industrial Design Association. I think there was at the time about 90 courses for delivering industrial design, product design, bachelors. And I think from the industry, I've got the statistic somewhere here. Well prepared, you can tell. It was about 50%, wasn't it, Brad, that basically preferred to have students from
three universities.
So there's an element of a filtration here. When you kind of think of kids, you know, I always say that everyone's, you know, enjoyed that process of drawing when you were a kid and building Lego. And you've got this unbelievable amount of people, and all we're doing through school is filtering. And it's also becoming now less accessible. So you could have a situation where, like you say, it could be a lot of independent schools that are breeding kids, or breeding kids that are developing students for top universities, and maybe the only those top universities have been therefore going into industry. So it just becomes like, surely you want the opposite of this funnel, right? You don't want to make this more and more niche in that situation.
Yeah, this is actually the first episode of the podcast we've done since we've launched the page, actually, if you think about it. And just, I'll be quick on it, but like, I can't remember the last time I went into a design studio and they were like, Brad, I want to increase the level of diversity in this team. That's like the number one goal here. You just fundamentally can't do that unless there is an infrastructure in place from education, whether that be primary school or whatever, through that kind of period up to university, where if you're putting things in place like internships at £400 a month, how can someone physically like survive on that unless they're born into money? It's impossible. And so just what I would say is also, I'm actually going to mainly aim this at students. So we do get the odd student probably listens to this. You cannot accept internships at that level. If you're equally as passionate about increasing the level of diversity in our field, you have to understand your own worth. And you cannot accept internships at that. You just fundamentally cannot. So as much as we aim this at, you know, directors, business founders, whatever, you know, effectively kind of cheap, kind of exploitative labor, it's also important that students really have understanding your own worth. And if we are going to change the notion that design is effectively just full of middle-class white guys with, you know, double-barreled names that like skiing in the winter, you know, we're only going to do that by everyone pulling together. And that's just my one kind of, you know, I was up at Design Council talking about this the other day. You know, it's something that we're really, really passionate about here. And we're only going to do this if we pull together. And I suppose that's similar, I'll kind of go full circle, it's similar to the piece around kind of D&T. Industry has to get involved in this, I'd imagine, Tony, to help with this, you know, declining numbers. If it's not going to come from government, if they see it as a hobby subject, how can industry get involved and turn things kind of full circle?
We've got a number of partners that we're working closely with at the moment who have, the initiative's called Blueprint 1000. I mean, it's pretty cool, Nee, but we want to connect up 1,000 schools and businesses over the course of the next 5 years. That's the plan. And why do we need to do that? Well, there's a whole stack of reasons. Let me run through a few of them. From the school's perspective, you always learn better if there's context. If there is context to what you're doing in school, it doesn't matter whether you're a boy, a girl, it doesn't matter whether you're 14 or you're 11. It's easier to learn if there's context. Why am I learning this maths? Because there's an exam at the end of the year and you'll need this. That never flicked my switch when I was 14, and it doesn't flick many kids' switches. It's got to be, you're learning this maths because there's this job out there that needs it, and there's that job out there that needs it. Now, I know this works. We used to use, in my school, we used to use the local industrial estate, which was like the biggest in Europe, business estate, I should say, not industrial. And we used to take the kids out there, and we used to put them out of their comfort zone completely. And then they would come back and they would say, I've seen this job. And it was Brompton Bikes was one that springs to mind. And there was design jobs available and technician jobs available at Brompton. But the kids came back knowing that they couldn't do that without GCSE maths. I then had boys chasing me down the corridor saying, what have I got to do to get a C? What have I got to do? At the moment, I'm predicted a D. I need a C. Help. Now, when you've got kids chasing you down a corridor, and like these weren't SWATs either, believe me, they were not SWATs. They're chasing me down a corridor trying to better their grades because they've seen the goal. They've seen what they want to go to. That's what we've got to do. So our Blueprint members at the moment are joining us for a few reasons. The first reason is diversity. And like, you know, what you just said there, Brad, that luckily there are some companies out there that are joining us and are saying, do you know what? We've had a look around. We're based in a part of London that is incredibly diverse. But when we look around the workforce that we've got in the room here, it doesn't reflect what's outside the door. And it isn't going to unless we do something different.
It's not going to change overnight, is it? You know, this is a long-term kind of...
This will take 3 to 4 years minimum. in order to change it. But if we get into the right schools and we show them how exciting the work can be, then you're going to get some people that will want to come in and will want to do some work placements and will want to learn a little bit more and may well apply for some of those roles that come from more diverse backgrounds. So that's a long-term, a long journey, but you're right, it's not a one-year program. We've also got the other reasons that they join is talent acquisition, where you know, you used to just stick your job advert out and you'd have 100 applicants and then you'd shift down to the best one. You stick your job advert out now and you get 100 applicants, but none of them are right for the job. So you spend all that time shuffling through. Much, much better if you can find 10 kids early on and you can nurture them through, and maybe three of those will actually come and work for you later on. So again, long burn. It's not a quick solution. And then beautifully and surprisingly, there are a few companies that have joined us that have just said, you know what, we're doing well and we like what we do here. We're really proud of what we do here and we just want to share it. We want to get out there and we want to share it with a younger audience. So we've got some that really don't want very much other than to show what they're doing to other people. And we're hoping, this has just started, it's only 18 months old, but we're hoping in the next 4 or 5 years we'll be able to build those numbers up. And we'll be able to have impact in almost every city in the UK. From a design perspective, it's predominantly London at the moment for obvious reasons. From an engineering perspective, we're picking people up all over the country.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something
that's
we could do.
Blueprint 1000, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a website. It's blueprint1000.org.uk. And if you want to have a look at that, everything that you need to know is pretty much on that website.
Do you know if... Actually, I put something up on Instagram the other day when you and you were coming on, and I just put a question out, which was like, do you ever go into your local school? When was the last time you went into your local school? I remember we spoke off camera and you were talking about a time that you went to a school and one of your designers was like a student that was there in the class. You came in.
Yeah. At my design reality, I'd always had an interest in education. One of my six options for university was to be a D&T teacher, but decided to go into industry and then thought I could always top it up with a PGC if I wanted to. That was mindset at the time. But yeah, so at Design Reality, I kind of had an interest that we need to do something with schools. I still got that burning interest. How can we help connect with local schools? And we did I think it was like a 8-module selection for different D&T teachers. And I would go every Friday afternoon, or one afternoon every fortnight, to different schools, and they could pick some 3D printing, or I do some concept sketching or some research skills. Or was it? I had about 8 kind of as classic little modules we could do, and it was great. And then I won't say the designer's name because it'd be really embarrassing. He's quite shy, but he's probably one of the best designers I've ever worked with, and he remembers me going to his school. He was kind of in GCSE, and yeah, kind of 5 years later, he ended up at Design Reality, and he's a phenomenal designer, and that link there, and it's kind of, you know, I think there's actually could be a couple of others that have also mentioned to me that they remember me coming into the school, so it has an effect. And you know, when you think about the Design Truth website, the map that's on there, we've got really nice spread of design agencies, designers, manufacturers all over the country. Is there something there, right? In my opinion, there's something that could happen.
I mean, you mentioned the round tables earlier on. I mean, one of the things that's come out from the round tables that we've done so far is if we were to build Blueprint from its current 28 members up to let's say 120, then almost every secondary school in the country would be within reach of a Blueprint partner. Now that can make an impact. That can do exactly what you've just described there now. And that's what we're looking to do. That's what we're seeking to do. We started this 18 months ago in lockdown. I want to get to a point where every school can reach out and get experience in from somebody, whether that is online. And we're doing some webinars at the moment with some of our Blueprint partners. And can I name the agency that we're working with?
Do whatever you want.
Echo joined us, and Echo basically they just want to give back. They just want to give back. They said, we just want to do some stuff with schools and we want to inspire kids to want to work in design. Now, they did a 4-hour online teacher sort of, it's like an internship for teachers online. It's the first one we tried like that. So we said to Echo, look, can you pick 5 or 6 members of these staff, wherever you feel is right, get them to give their journey to where they are now, get them to explain what they do and how they do it and what the main bits of their job are. And what we're trying to do is feed the teachers knowledge, because most of the teachers will have come from school, university, back to school. They've never been in an agency. They don't know what an agency works like. All of the teachers came out of that session and said, my teaching's going to change as a result of that. I'm now going to go back and I'm going to take what I've learned from that and I'm going to bring that back to the classroom. Plus Echo said, we're getting a much, much better perspective of how schools work. Mm. And that's going to help us in our recruitment later on. So it works both ways.
I wonder, obviously, we'll probably talk about this. Obviously, we're not recording a roundtable next week, but I wonder if things could be put into employment contracts where it's like, you know, you have to spend time going into your local schools, where companies say that, you know, if you're employing a designer into your business, it's like once a month, once a quarter, you have to go to your local school. And it seems like that at scale, that's the thing, it's at scale across the country. That is what could turn this around, in my opinion.
It's at scale. And what we can do, which is really, really essential, is that schools are notoriously difficult places to communicate with. You know, they're almost built that way. And if you're outside, we talked to one guy who runs an agency, and he said, I went and knocked on the door of my local school. They sat me down in reception. They left me waiting there for over an hour. And then finally, the head of careers came down and said, oh, yeah, we've got a careers fair next July. We can give you an hour on the table with year 10. He said, that's not what I'm offering. What I'm offering is I'll come in and talk to your students. I'll take students into my studio and I'll show them. Oh, no, we don't do any of that. Now, you need somebody in the middle to connect the two sides up, because they don't connect automatically. So when you join us as a Blueprint member, the first thing we do is, great, you're in, brilliant. All right, and there's a cost attached to that, £3,750. That £3,750 allows us to do all of the interim stuff. So we sit down and we say, okay, in 12 months' time, what does success look like to you? What do you want to do? And they might mention diversity. They might mention that they want talent acquisition to be part of it. They might want to run a competition that is going to go across a set number of schools in their area, whatever it might be. We then put that on paper and we then work out how we're going to deliver that and what schools we're going to reach out to make that work. And we go in through the design and technology department. So it's the head of design and technology we contact. We've got an agency that wants to work with you. This is what we want to do. Can you help us with that? And they'll either say yes or no. If they say no, we move on to the next school and we line it up. But the agency's got to do nothing. We do all the work. We connect the whole thing together. All they've got to do then is be willing to work with us to make it happen.
And that cost is probably down to, I don't know if you guys get external support. I think I read that you have to run as a business, really, because you just don't.
No, we don't get any government funding at all. Everything that we do, we have to. Now, that £3,750 basically means that we do all the groundwork on that. So if there's any safeguarding to be done, we do that. If there is a connection or a curriculum project to draw up as part of it, we'll draw the curriculum project up. If what they want to do is they want to do webinars, we'll host the whole webinar, we'll set the webinar up, we'll make sure the teachers come into it, we'll work with the agency to make sure they're fully prepped for the webinar so they're not going in cold. The whole work is done. And we're not for profit. We don't make money. We just need to break even, that's all.
Hmm. It's an interesting thing that I think I've spoken to Brad a long time about this, is that I think this Design Truth network of industrial designers, it's great. And we've all had, I guess, a whinge about everything that's wrong with the profession and trying to improve it. And I think that's been great over the last kind of 18 months, 2 years. I think the real power of Design Truth and that industry group of designers now is getting working with other networks, right? And I think you've got another network then of a whole load of design and technology teachers that are out there. And I think that's that's where it gets really, really powerful. It kind of multiplies the effect. I think that's really, really interesting. And then, you know, I think about something you said right at the start is that, I think it was, you know, which one of you, either of you said it, but it was that if we want to try and improve the value of design, that everybody else understands the value of design, it's important that the non-designers understand the value of design. Because if they're not the ones who end up being designers, they can go, oh, do you know, we did this subject at school, and it was great. We solved this problem that had never been solved before for a group of people who really needed this problem to be solved. And, you know, that's the center of entrepreneurship, right? and from that perspective, you can build businesses around it. I mean, there's a chap called Dyson who's done that quite well. And it's kind of going, how do we, therefore, you know, develop people to understand that value of design, because they might not just be designers. And I think that's, in essence, helps, because what we've got at the moment is kind of pure economics. We've got, I've never seen demand for design as much as I've seen now. It's honestly, it's bonkers, whether it's industrial, digital, or everybody wants designers. But then we've got a crisis of supply. So, you know, like that's the nature of where we're at. So we've got, that's got to be improved, the pure economics of that.
Looking at the heart of the subject, I said earlier on, we're not there to create the workforce of the future. That's part of what we do. And yeah. You know, I've never shied away from that as an educator. I've been criticised sometimes for saying that, and I don't know why. I've never understood that. You know, if part of the job of education is not to prepare people for the world of work, what's something missing there? But you know, for me, that's always been part of it. But there are going to be kids that at 13 decide that that's as far as they go with design and technology, and they walk away from it. At the very least, I want them to be the pickiest of consumers. I want them to walk in and go, I'm not buying that, because in 2 years, that's in landfill. I'm not having that. Or I'm not going to, you know, I don't need another T-shirt. My daughter, she wears everything secondhand because she said it's better made, it's more stylish, and it's not going to end up in landfill. You know, I can do it. That generation are aware that my generation has created a massive problem for them, and they want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And design and technology gives them, it empowers them to be part of the solution. And that's underrated, because, you know, if you're 15 years old and you feel that there's a massive issue out there and you can't do anything about it, that is completely disempowering. And if we can give kids that power back through the subject, which I believe we do, then that's a positive part of the subject. So, yeah, at 13, if we turn them out and they're the pickiest designers, you know, we do this thing on the circular economy, which a lot of schools do now. And you just pick a pair of jeans and you just look, where are the jeans made? Where were they dyed? How were they dyed? You know, where's the offshoot from that dye gone? Has it gone into a local stream, or where's it gone? How have they been transported? How have they got over here? What's the carbon footprint? And once you've done all of that, kids never want to buy another pair of jeans in their life. Unless I know that it's been made within 20 miles up the road from me, I'm not interested in it. Now, that's mad, but it makes them think differently about things that are important.
I've got a question for you, to be intrigued around, I guess, what we classically call subjects. And, like, I think if I'm correct, that Finland they've rethought education where they don't necessarily have the subjects, and that you have a problem. And like you said before, if you've got a problem that, like you said about your car engines, right, is that you learn physics, you learn maths, you learn various things because you're centered around that problem, and that design becomes, I guess, that facilitation of learning other subjects. And, you know, like, essentially kind of memorize all these things, you know, these other subjects, where essentially now you can Google anything, right, and you can get those information. Is it, I guess, the question I'm asking deeper is, are there leaders of other countries that we could kind of go benchmark and kind of say, when you said, when we started off and there was 400,000 students and it was compulsory 30 years ago, and now we've got to the state of where we're at, can we learn from other people, and other countries rather, about best practices?
I've taught over my years, I've taught A-level, I've taught GCSE, I've taught the IB as well. The IB is a much, much better offer from my perspective.
That's the International Baccalaureate.
Now, the IB is a qualification that you do at 18, you don't do at 16. I mean, there's one question straight away. Do we really need GCSEs, right? That's radical. But I don't think we do. I think, you know, why are we putting kids through? Because what you do, when you put a layer like that in of examinations, you basically start at that layer and then you work down to what have I got to do to pass that exam. So as soon as you put that in at 16, you, whether you want to or not, you influence the curriculum that leads to it completely. And you create, you take the freedom of that curriculum away. If we only examine kids at 18, which the IB does, then actually you create freedom in that curriculum where you can blend subjects together and you can do things differently. Doesn't mean that you lose content. It doesn't mean that you lose academic grounding. You don't. But you will, I mean, the design and technology curriculum in the IB, for example, is far broader and opens itself to working with physics and working with maths and bringing stuff in a much easier, more linear, more fluid way than the A level does. And so, yeah, there are examples out there. We need to look, and we also need to look at countries like China. I mean, I was over in China, trying to think how many years it was ago, about 7 years ago. And I was over there with a delegation of head teachers, and I was lucky enough to lead a delegation of head teachers over there. And we met government ministers, and the government ministers were pretty clear. They said, the way our education is at the moment, we are the manufacturing capital of the world, and that's all we will ever be if we don't change our education system. We want to put more creativity into our education system. Now, for them to say that, that's massive, because it was straight line learning, teacher at the front. It was like going back to 1920. But they wanted us over there to show them how we were doing it so as they could break their system apart. They're already starting to do that. They're already making. Now, if we don't wake up, we're going to fall behind pretty quick. And we will not, you know, a lot of the design work that's here will be done somewhere else. It will be done somewhere else, and it will be done cheaper. And it will be done probably more efficiently. We need to wake up, and like education is part of that. It's not the whole picture, but it's part of it.
Yeah, on that one, I've definitely seen. I was talking to a client yesterday about it, that you find a lot less international kind of optimism of wanting to come to the UK as well, particularly. You know, I don't get many applications from designers in Europe anymore wanting to come to London, you know, just off the political nature of the last couple of years. So equally, we're less reliant, dare I say, on people coming over, whether it be on a youth mobility visa, ancestral visa, or whether they're just EU citizens or whatnot. So there's also that point as well, where it is that the supply, the nature of the supply is also changing. You know, there's less appetite fundamentally in people outside of the UK wanting to work here in the industrial design space. And so that's the nature of that supply, with it going down. Also, you can't rely on just someone, you know, coming over from Australia or something for 2-3 years. And that is something that actually, when you do look in a lot of design businesses in the UK, you actually look at the different members of staff in those companies, not many of them are actually educated in the UK. You know, there's quite a big portion of them have come from external parts of the globe, and that supply is also, you know, on the down as well. So that's why it's even more integral to get the UK education system as best as it possibly can be.
It does work though, bro. I mean, you know, I've probably painted a pretty negative picture there, but you know, there are schools, and like, you know, I did one of our podcasts earlier this week, and it was a student from the Dyson Institute that I had on the podcast, and she did design and technology A level, and she said, you know, it was only design and technology at A level that made me realise that there were certain bits of the maths that I was doing that actually transferred really easily, and huge chunks of the physics that transferred over. And she said, I really started to blend my learning at sixth form in a way that I'd never done up until the age of 16. So it does work. And like, I don't want to paint a picture that it doesn't happen. It does. I just want to, I want to, I want to stress in there, I mean, there is a danger with all those stats that we started with, you know, that you dig yourself a big hole that you can't see out of.
Yeah.
And I am one of life's eternal optimists, and I refuse to be beaten by this. You know, this subject really matters. We've got to do a number of things. One is we've got to train the workforce to operate collectively at a higher level. You know, part of the issue is they've not been trained for a while. As somebody said earlier on, the subject changes constantly because the technology outside changes constantly, and that feeds into our subject straight away. So if I'm teaching a mainstream curriculum subject, I could probably go 5 years if I'm teaching geography and I wouldn't lose too much. But if I go 5 years without any external training in design and technology, I'm way behind the curve. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the issue. So there are things that we're going to do, and there are things that we can do that will actually solve this, I think. We need to get more research into the subject. We need to prove, you know, when we say problem solving is one of the things that the CBI and others put at the top of their list of what they're looking for, problem solvers, we quite openly say design and technology produces problem solvers in a way that nothing else does in the curriculum. Well, let's prove that. Let's do some research and absolutely prove that, so as we've got something definitive to fall back on, because we haven't got that at the moment. So, yeah, I don't want to paint a completely negative picture, because the subject's not dead. It is, it's got a big bleed, and we're in trouble, but it is, we're rescuable. And I think we've got probably 4 years to do it. What I would say to anyone listening to this that is listening to it and thinking, well, just imagine a world without design and technology. Would we lose anything? Would there be, you know, would you look back in 5-6 years' time and think, oh, I wish I'd done more to save that? And that's my nightmare. You know, that my nightmare is I'm 59 now. If I'm still working when I'm 66, something's gone wrong. So in that time, I want to make sure that we put the subject on firm groundings. I don't want to look back at 66 and think, could have done more. There's actually much more we could have done. We could have been braver. I think we've got to be brave now if we really value this subject. We've got to make a move now. We've got to do something big.
Yeah, just looking on our Instagram, we had lots of messages from people that work in industry, and we just put a question out, which was like, what are your early memories of design education? And quite a lot of them were like, had a great teacher, inspired me to pursue a career in industry. So lots of kind of positivity around it. There's lots of nostalgia, isn't there, I think, when people look back on design education. So I completely agree with you. It's like trying to kind of make sure that's still there and it's not doom and gloom, as you say, and it's making people kind of look back with good garments. So
I think it's one of the things that I think Jude Pullman put it in last year today, like, of all the subjects in you can show off in a secondary school, design technology is such an exciting, fun subject. I think it's a subject like no other. And I think the fact that, you know, visually the prototypes or the activity you can have in there that can be used to attract students, it's such a fun subject. And I think that's the type of thing that I think we all hark back to. Every person we've had on this podcast has talked so favorably about the design education. And I think that's a thing that we've got to keep at the core, and I think try and make sure that everyone remembers that. And I think that hopefully that inspires designers and people listening to this to get involved in this campaign, I guess.
Engagement's never been a problem with our subjects. You know, our primary membership base is growing out of all proportion at the moment. You know, a few years ago we had 3,500 primary members. We've now got over 27,000 primary members. So at primary school level, they're realizing there's a little bit more flex on the primary school curriculum because they haven't got that. They've got SATs, but they haven't got those exams at the end of the day. So they've got more room to play with the curriculum and do things. And they find that once they introduce design and technology, it teaches maths in a way that they would find difficult to teach in a maths lesson. It teaches physics in a way that they would find difficult to teach in a science lesson. And the primary teachers are a joy to work with because they're so enthusiastic once they start teaching it. The kids love it. I love it. Everyone's having a great time. And look at all that we're learning. And then at secondary level, that's happening in some schools, but in some schools we're beaten. And I understand this completely. You're beaten by the pressure to get the results, because without the results, the GCSE results and the A-level results, you're really at risk with Ofsted. So you've
funding and, you know, et cetera. Yeah. It's all linked, isn't it?
A whole lot tied in. So from the minute you arrive as a secondary teacher, you're under pressure to deliver, you know, deliver those results and deliver them. And, you know, one of the things that we haven't talked about, and I'll talk about it very, very quickly, I have got the option, if I want to, of switching to art and design, calling it design and technology, soft design and technology, and doing an art and design examination at the end of it instead of a design and technology examination. Now, why would I do that? Well, I haven't got all the core that I've got in design and technology, the materials, processes, machinery, etc. All of that's gone. So all that core content I haven't got to deliver, and I might not be comfortable with it if I haven't trained in it. And then the exam in art and design is 100% coursework. So I've got no exams at the end of it. So it's easier to get higher grades. So if I'm under that pressure in school, I understand that some people will go to that. But what's happening in schools is we've got art and design being delivered in design and technology, and we've got art and design being delivered in art and design. And then it only takes a couple of years before the governors go, why are we delivering the same subject twice? Let's drop one and save 250,000 quid. Mm. And that's what's happening. That's what's happening in schools, is they're dropping. And when they drop one, it's always design and technology because it's the most expensive. So, yeah, there are issues out there. There are problems out there. But we're going to put solutions in place. We need industry to get behind this. We need people to back us. And we're going to fight our way out of this one because this subject's important.
Yeah. Just quickly, final question for Mick. How does someone in industry, if they're ever thinking about it, the career change, how do they become a D&T teacher? And why should they become a D&T teacher?
Right. Let's tackle the how first of all. How's easy? It's a one-year qualification. You can actually train in situ. So you can train in the job now, and you can do your PGCE whilst you're in school. Salaries are not bad, actually. You know, you're going to start with industrial experience probably on somewhere around 36-37k, somewhere around that. And if you you'll go up the scale pretty quickly if you're good. So it's relatively easy to start. So you're either looking for a skit locally, so it's a school training program, so you can train on site, or you're looking for a university that will do PGCEs locally to you, that will pick up, that you can do it that way. And then why would you do it? Honestly, I just am so fortunate and so blessed to have been in the position that I was in. Teaching is the best job in the world. You know, I always describe it as you're like a stand-up comic, that you walk into the room and you've got an audience of 25 in there who, if you stink with your performance, they will let you know. And you have got probably the first 3 minutes to win that audience over and to get them on your side. And it becomes easier as they know you because they trust you. But once they trust you and once they know you, there is nowhere you can't take that audience. There is no level of design that you can't teach them. And they will let you lead them down areas that frighten the bejesus out of them because they don't have the skill sets and the knowledge, but they'll let you take and explore things. And it's a joy. It's an absolute joy. And when you got students at the end that, you know, I've been on the train and had the Mr. Chips moment where someone's come over to me and said, I remember you. You did this at school and it's made such a difference to my life. Now, how many people can actually say, you know, they've had that feedback? It's the best thing. One anecdote very quickly. My mum had a major heart operation a few years ago, and like, she was in intensive care, and the nurse kept clocking me. The intensive care nurse kept clocking me whilst I was trying to get into mum to see how she was. And she went, you taught me at school. You taught me design and technology. I got an A. And she said, and the only reason I'm here now is it interested me in technology. So I thought, I'm interested in technology. I'm interested in medicine. And now I'm an intensive care nurse. I will look after your mum. You know, I mean, that's a personal story, but that is why you should teach, because it's the best job. Mm. It gets negative press, but it is a wonderful, empathetic, rewarding job.
Lovely. I think it's a great thing to end on as well, unless you've got anything with that you wanted to...
Such an interesting subject, and like I said, I think we could talk for hours and hours, and looking forward to meeting you in person next week.
I've got pages on pages of notes here from the last two sessions, so you're going to be busy on Thursday, so sleep well Wednesday night.
Now, I know what you're thinking, Brad, you shamelessly didn't plug the sponsor enough in the intro, so I'll give it another go. Well, Solid Solutions, they do actually sponsor this podcast. They are the number one in all things SolidWorks, whether that be getting the license, getting a half-decent price for it as well, training, kind of ongoing support. They're a good bunch. They've signed up to our internship pledge. They've been really supportive with the podcast, so kudos to them down there. There's a link in the description to a program that they run, which allows startups to get SolidWorks for free, which is fantastic. So check that out if that's appropriate to you, maybe someone you know, a client or whatever. Stay safe, everyone. And Bristol, 29th of June, tacos, few drinks. It's the second stop on the Design Truth World Tour. There's going to be some chat from some of the designers at LV, Kinnear DeFore. And look forward to seeing some of you there. Until next time.